A few more here to make sure. I think YouTube is just picking this up because people watch the event afterward and we want them to be able to have the full experience and know who they're listening to is the most important thing. So I think we're okay now. Thank you, everyone. I'm Catherine Lopez from the National Review Institute, and I'm here. We're co-sponsoring this event with the Christ Medicus Foundation. And we have here Lewis Brown and Joseph Meany and Alexander Schneider. Joseph Meany is the president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Alexander Schneider is executive director of the Life Legal Defense Foundation. And my co-sponsoring group, Christ Medicus, the executive director is Lewis Brown. And Lewis was the person who came to me about the possibility of this event. And I'm grateful. I was thinking at the same time that we needed to have something about the intersection between life issues and healthcare and religious liberty and civil liberty and really civil rights. And you know, this year has been tremendous in some regards in at least the lip service to protecting the vulnerable. Now, sometimes the reality isn't quite what the words are. And so that's why we're gathered here today to talk about some of the things that are going on and how we can better protect people. And can I just go around first, Lewis, could you help set up this conversation a little bit more? And then if Alexandra and Joseph, if you would just say something to explain to people why you're here, why you're part of this new task force that Lewis will tell us about, and maybe the most important thing to know about you and what you bring to the table here. I'll add first that I'm so grateful to the National Catholic Bioethics Center. It is a treasure of resources, including, this is something that I didn't realize, I'm really embarrassed to say I didn't realize until about a month ago. You have like a 24-hour hotline for people who are dealing with end-of-life issues. You don't know what to do with your mother, your father, you know, a family member. You're in the hospital and you don't know who to call for help. The National Catholic Bioethics Center, you can call. Amazing resource. So anyhow, Lewis, you first.
Sure. And Catherine, thank you so much for the opportunity to have this discussion. It feels very providential. We're very grateful for your wisdom that you provide our country and have for years. And I mean that both personally and professionally. And want to thank Joseph and Alex and the other members of the task force for working really hard, particularly the last couple of weeks, and particularly this week, to do some of the work we're doing. It is an honor and a blessing to just be in the same venue with you all. For me, some of the conceptualization of this effort to defend and advance healthcare civil rights started, years ago, but in terms of where we are now, this past spring, summer, when I had the opportunity to read Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, where he talks about a new birth of freedom. And as so much of the angst and the concern and the pain around the lingering effects of racism in our country was made evident and we were all dealing with it, it became clear that in as much as Abraham Lincoln the need for a new birth of freedom in his second inaugural, we here in the United States need a new birth of civil rights. We particularly need a new birth of civil rights in our country when it comes to healthcare. It's beautiful because it brings so many of these issues that people think are should be isolated, siloed together. And so for the Christ Medicus Foundation with our partners, this is an opportunity to put into action that call for a new birth of civil rights, particularly in healthcare, which impacts all Americans and which is so needed in our country right now.
Alexandra?
So my introduction to this kind of work started through Life Legal, and I joined Life Legal really to address the abortion issue, not realizing that a large chunk of our work is has to do with the denial of life-sustaining care, so and these types of healthcare civil rights. So Life Legal is a nonprofit pro-life law firm, and we have just seen the number of cases that the calls that we get asking for help, pleading for help to save people's lives when they're being just denied care that, and in some cases, even routine care, in a lot of cases, food and water, just basic human rights that are being denied in hospitals all across this country to people who need them. So, yeah.
And Joseph.
Hi, yes. So I'm president of the National Catholic Bioethics Center, which has existed for several decades now. And as you say, we do have, we're actually the largest Catholic bioethics institute in the US. So we have 6 full-time ethicists and 3 part-time ethicists. And if people want to get a free ethics consult, they can contact us through our website. So it's ncbcenter.org. But I've been very personally impacted by this issue. So back in May, I had a life-threatening heart attack and was rushed to the hospital. My wife asked for a priest to come anoint me because I was in danger of death. And they said, oh, we'll send you a chaplain. And they sent this person who was not even Catholic, could not give me the sacraments. And then when I came out of recovery in ICU, et cetera, again, I was asking for a priest. They told no visitation whatsoever. No priest on staff for this a secular hospital, and no family member could come and visit me. So I was like, oh my gosh, you know, and I recovered within 3 days, I was out. But if I had been dying, I would have died alone. And so it's a very personal issue for me. And I think it's just an unconscionable violation of civil rights that so many people, unfortunately, have been forced to die without the presence of their loved ones, without the comfort and assistance of clergy and the sacraments. So I think it's just an issue that's really touching a lot of nerves, and we need to be very attentive to it.
I've heard so many stories and have so many close friends who have been in similar situations, you know, cancer complications, could die, no priest available, you know. A good friend of mine died earlier this month, and a priest basically had to beg to get in, and was successful by some miracle. But you shouldn't have to beg, and you shouldn't be refused. So there are a number of different aspects of this that the task force is seeking to really lead on. Can we talk, probably right now, the most critical thing to talk about is the what looks like inevitable second shutdown. And as I was sharing before, you know, in our so-called green room, before we came on live, I went to Mass in Midtown Manhattan this morning. I was nowhere near anyone except for the priest who gave me communion, and he had hand sanitizer next to him and was wearing a mask. Then I go to a deli in New York to pick up some breakfast, and you know, there are young guys who are not wearing their masks and they're not socially distancing. I contend you're safer in a Catholic church than anywhere in the world right now. We should not be shut down. People need the spiritual care. We've all seen the statistics about young people in June who wanted to kill themselves, like seriously wanted to kill themselves. And that's what we know of, right? So Lewis, talk about what we can proactively do to prevent the churches being shut down and to prevent the draconian measures in terms of spiritual care that we saw the first time around.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things to think about. And I think Joseph and Alex have great thoughts as well on this, particularly on this religious freedom issue. It's important as we think about civil rights, we're talking about our natural human and civil rights from conception to natural death, right? And that has a particular impact on those that are vulnerable. One of our first freedoms, one of the most important freedoms along with the right to life, is that civil right, that natural human and civil right to religious freedom. There's a reason why the Constitution protects it as that first freedom articulated in the First Amendment. There's a reason for that. And so we absolutely have to protect it. It is a right that precedes the state. It's a right that precedes the federal government. It's a very important right that we have. In terms of what you talked about, Catherine, I think the first thing, it's important for people of faith and Christ Medicus Foundation, it's a Catholic nonprofit, so I'll speak particularly to our Catholic bishops and laity. From what we've seen at the Christ Medicus Foundation, and I think our partners as well, there has been no reported transmission of COVID whatsoever in Catholic churches from Mass that we know of that's been reported. And so even on a natural basis, right? Even on a natural basis, we don't think that there is any reason whatsoever to start canceling Mass all over again. It's just not there whatsoever. It's just not there on a scientific basis. The transmission just isn't happening. And I think you're right on a human level. When you walk into the grocery store and it's packed and you're around a lot of people, or I was on an airplane from North Carolina back to DC that was packed with 300 people. We're clearly not socially distanced, but they're saying, you know, well, maybe we need to limit Mass attendance to 10 people in a massive church. It doesn't make any sense. So on a natural level, it just doesn't appear to be necessary whatsoever when it comes to the transmission of the virus. I think it's important that the bishops recognize that it is important and vital as it is to protect the physical health of all Americans and their flock. It is even more important to protect the eternal health of everyone's flock. And so I think that's the first thing, is that I think we need to see bishops and lay leaders, the diocese, to stand up and to make sure that people are giving the spiritual care that they need, recognizing that going to Mass, having the churches open, it's not hurting anyone, it's actually helping people. That's number one. I think number two, to the degree that we may see state and local leaders try to shut down churches again, and in some cases, there are certain limits in certain parts of the country right now, I think bishops should, and lay leaders, and for our Protestant brothers and sisters and Jewish brothers and sisters, their leadership, I think, should seriously consider lawsuits. The Justice Department has affirmed the reality that there's no public health exception to the First Amendment. There are reasonable things that should be done to comply where it's just with health and safety guidelines. But the idea that the government can just shut down churches just doesn't make sense. I think the third thing is something that Monsignor Pope, who is an amazing priest in Washington, D.C., talked about. Again, we're talking the first thing being, let's just not unilaterally cancel Mass. Let's continue Mass, number one. Number two, the consideration of legal action where warranted. And then number three, if necessary, I believe that people of faith, again, assuming that folks are following just guidelines that the public health officials have provided, should consider just saying no. Should consider saying no. And that would be appropriate. And, as St. Augustine said, as Martin Luther King said in a letter from a Birmingham jail, an unjust law is no law at all.
And I just want to reiterate to people who are listening, who perhaps have not been in a house of worship for a long time, the protocols are in place. People are being safe. People are being conscious. And also, people who are especially vulnerable are being encouraged to stay home so that this isn't a danger to them, but finding ways to have pastoral care for them at the same time. Alexandra, how do we keep from having another shutdown?
So I live in California and we are already on lockdown 2.0. And really I've looked at the data, and in most counties in California, this is not a scientific lockdown. There really are no rational justifications for locking us down again. So in some counties, for example, you have an increase in cases of 100%. So cases have doubled. Well, what they are not telling you is that there were 4 active cases and now there's 8 in a county of, 250,000 people or something. It's just, it does not make sense. So I'm with Lewis. I agree. I think church leaders need to step up, particularly when our fundamental freedoms are in jeopardy, as they are now and as they are right now in California. They need to step up and file lawsuits. And there is some success there. There's a church in Southern California. It's a Protestant church, but they are able to continue because they said, we're not playing this game anymore. Our freedoms, we are the stewards of our freedoms. And if we don't step up, nobody's going to do that.
And I have to say a word for Bishop Cortiglione in San Francisco, who has been being heroic in trying to get people the sacraments. And as well, I'm grateful for Bishop DiMarzio in Brooklyn, who just went to the Supreme Court because he lost in state court. Joseph, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that I think we should keep in mind is that we're in a very different place from when the initial lockdowns were put into practice, right? In the beginning, we just didn't know a lot. We didn't know how serious the disease was going to be. We didn't have a lot of preparation. We didn't know how to treat the disease. So there were just a lot of unknowns that justified, you know, some preventative measures. And I think we pretty much everyone kind of agreed, yeah, okay, sure. I mean, maybe we need to do some extraordinary things because this is just an unprecedented situation. Now, months have gone by. We see that, you know, for the vast, vast majority of people, you know, under age 70, without underlying conditions, your chance of dying of COVID, if you're infected, are less than 1%, you know, one-tenth of 1%. So in a sense, we have so much better treatment. We have so much better, you know, protocols and knowledge of how it's transmitted, et cetera, that we can see what is safe and what is not. And so to try and put the exact same measures that were put into place earlier into place again would be, I would say, repeating something with the knowledge that we have now would be just unconscionable.
And Catherine, if I could add onto what Joseph, the great words from Joseph and Alex, I think there's a couple things too that we should add. I think it's important that we all recognize that COVID-19 is a very serious disease. There are people that have passed away that I know. There are other folks that have gotten it and have had a rough time. There's someone that's like a family member that was in the hospital. He's like a family member to my family. He was in the hospital from COVID just last night. We're all worried about him, praying for him and trying to make sure that he gets the care that he needs. And so it's extraordinarily serious. Just guidelines that are reasonable and mandates that are reasonable at the state and local level, they should be followed 100%. But at the same time, what we've seen extraordinarily is even the World Health Organization, which has a massive influence on global health, which is opposed to a lot of things that we believe and our healthcare civil rights task force members believe about the dignity of the human person, even though they're opposed on many of these issues in comparison to where we stand, the World Health Organization has even said that lockdowns have a limited impact and can have extraordinarily negative consequences, particularly on the poor. And particularly as I think about folks that are small business owners, folks in minority communities that cannot take that kind of prolonged impact. Obviously, minority communities are highly susceptible to this virus for a lot of other issues that gets into some of those civil rights issues. And so it's impacted them on the health side, but it's also impacted them economically. And we need to be aware of that. We need to take a whole view of the person, body, mind, and soul, as we have talked about in the statement that we released today.
I just want to interrupt the conversation for a moment to encourage people to send questions in the Q&A box. If you're watching on Zoom, if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can send me an email at klopez@nationalreview.com to ask a question of our panelists. There is one question in the box that Alexandra, maybe you can speak to, although it's responding to a Lewis statement. So Lewis, you can certainly have your say too. But the question is, even if there were cases of transmission at mass, that wouldn't be a reason to shut down masses because there's a 99% survival rate for those who get the disease. The other question that is frequently raised though is, if there's any chance that someone could get sick and die, shouldn't we shut everything down? Alexander, I think that's a real concern that people have, and that's certainly how some government officials like Andrew Cuomo in New York speak. How do you speak to that, Alexandra?
I mean, I think that there are good intentions. I don't want to attribute bad faith to every governor who's locking down their state, but we have to recognize, yes, COVID is very serious, and I don't want to tout the survival rate because there are people who don't survive it. And if you have pre-existing conditions, things like that, you are at particularly high risk, of course. So, but we don't, we have risks every day. And I mean, there are risks of flu, and apparently the number of flu cases, particularly deadly flu cases, is really down right now, in part probably because we're taking some of these measures. But you have to look, I mean, there is a balancing test. That's what courts do, is engage in this type of balancing test to see especially when you're talking about fundamental freedoms, is this the what's called the least restrictive means to ensure that those freedoms are protected? And I would say, again, in California, in most counties in California right now where we are, and what's happening in California is going to play out in other states in the coming days. So is this the least restrictive means to guarantee our fundamental right to worship God, our fundamental rights of expression, all of these things? And I would have to say, absolutely not. When churches are closed, I mean, in California right now, churches are closed. We're talking again about, can we have services outside? What does that look like in the winter? But no, locking everybody down is an unconstitutional means of dealing with this problem. And we do have to recognize again that we accept risks in our life on a daily basis. Every time you get a new car, there's a risk of getting into an accident, and we're always engaging in that balancing test.
Joseph, about some of the issues that you experienced yourself, and that your organization exists to help people with, Alexandra mentioned before people being denied basics. There was that story of a man named Michael Hickson over the spring, who his wife could not get in to see him as he was dying of COVID. And he was disabled. So even the communications, if she was trying to have, you know, phone conversations, and they weren't even allowed at some points, and he did die alone, and he was denied the basics. And the concern of the family was that they were basically letting him die. And this is not an unusual thing to happen, is it,
Joseph? No, that's right. Unfortunately, I think, you know, something that the Justice Alito said recently in a Federalist Society talk, I think has a lot of validity. He basically said that we're witnessing an intensification of previous trends. You know, when you're in a crisis situation, people tend to go to further extremes in the direction they were already moving. And one of the problems, I think, is that our society has been moving in a much more secular, a much more, you know, in favor of the culture of death, all these different trends that I don't think are positive, but the COVID situation, the emergency, has kind of moved things in that direction. And I think there are some folks who think, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. As an ethicist, I have seen so many people come forward with very extreme proposals, basically because they could get away with it because we're in an emergency situation. And one thing that the Justice Alito said that I thought made a lot of sense is, like, you know, just because you slap on it's an emergency, it's a pandemic, whatever it is, on a certain measure, doesn't mean you can abrogate, you know, fundamental rights. You know, certainly precautions are justifiable, all kinds of reasonable things. But when you move into the realm of saying denying people fundamental rights, fundamental freedoms, then you end up committing injustice, you know? And unfortunately, there are some people who have this kind of, you know, utilitarian consequentialist philosophy, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number, and we can sacrifice people and do injustice to a small number if it'll help the larger number. From a Christian perspective, that does not work, right? The ends do not justify the means. And so I think it's very, very important to say, look, we will not sacrifice people just because, you know, it can help another group of people. We see that a lot in medical ethics, you know, particularly medical research, where they're like, oh, well, we can kill all these human embryos because we might be able to get a cure. You know, we can, you know, commit all these different injustices so that something good can come out of it. That's not how real virtue, real ethics works, certainly from a Catholic or a Christian perspective.
Well, it's terrifying to me too. And this hits on something Alexandra said earlier, how utilitarian views we take toward the elderly. I mean, that there are so many people in nursing homes in the first place, you know? And I'm not questioning decisions that people make, but it is like we warehouse people at a certain point in their lives. And we don't even fully know what happened in their nursing homes in the winter and spring. And that's unconscionable that we walk around away from this year and we don't even look at what happened. Lewis, so you were talking earlier about Black Lives Matter and how this is a piece of that. I frequently walk past Planned Parenthood in Lower Manhattan. There's graffiti all over the place about how Black Lives Matter, but we know that the majority of the babies who are being killed inside Planned Parenthood are Black or Hispanic, particularly in New York, the abortion capital of the world. And it's not just an abortion issue, right, Lewis? If Black lives actually matter to people with lawn signs that say so, what are the issues in healthcare we need to be looking at in civil rights and religious liberty?
Yeah, this is very important. So obviously abortion, which is murder, and it's abhorrent, and it has a it's bad if it happens to anyone. You know, one child being killed is unconscionable, going wrong. Sadly, there's been over 60 million abortions in the United States, and the projection is that, you know, over 19 million of those abortions have been of 19 million unborn Black children, right? So that's evil, wrong, and there's a horrible racist component to that, in my opinion. At the same time, and as much as we have to defend the unborn with maximum determination, as St. John Paul II talked about, we see that abortive mindset, that legacy of racial bias also within, and racial inequality within the healthcare system. You know, we have heroic doctors, nurses, hospital staff putting their lives on the line every day. Some have died in this process over the last year, saving lives of people they don't know. And so that needs to be celebrated, encouraged, and supported, absolutely. But at the same time, for a lot of African Americans, for Hispanics, for poor white folks, for other folks that are materially impoverished, and obviously, you know, that is across the racial spectrum, but we particularly see these issues in certain minority communities, too many Americans, particularly African Americans, and Hispanics don't have the same access to medical care that other folks that are economically more well off have. That's a problem. We have still have unequal access to medical care. It's not so much whether someone's got insurance or not, that's a component of it. But the question is, when someone needs medical care, can they get it? So there's an issue of unequal access to medical care for those that are lower income and in minority communities, but also those who are lower income in white communities, Hispanic communities, Asian communities across the board. That's an issue that needs to be dealt with. That first issue of unequal access to medical care that's not at the level that it should be given human dignity, number one. Number two, you also have this issue, particularly in parts of the African-American community, that we don't have access or in a culture of health and wellness that we should, which is why in certain parts of the United States, African Americans were more susceptible to this virus because, again, we don't have that access, but also having a culture and opportunity to increase our health and wellness, something that we just didn't have. That's issues of diet, that's issues of exercise. It's commonly called within the healthcare industry, health disparities. And so part of the work of that new birth of civil rights is ensuring that we have greater, more equal access to medical care for all Americans, particularly those who have been historically discriminated, particularly those who are vulnerable, particularly those in minority communities, but also ensuring that that those that are materially impoverished and those that are in historically marginalized communities, such as the African-American community in parts of the country, have access to health and wellness such that their health can just be better. And if you look at all of the pre-existing conditions that too many African-Americans have, that's an issue. I think the third thing is getting into this place of racial bias, which intersects with what we call, you know, what some folks call end of life care. But there are instances still in the United States of the unjust denial of medical care, a racial bias in medical care, because someone is deemed to have low quality of life. They may also happen to be a perhaps a poor white woman who doesn't have the patient advocacy of a community rallying around her, so she doesn't get the care that she should have. It could be an African-American man, like the case in Texas, who's disabled, who doesn't have the advocacy and support that he should have. It could be a Hispanic woman who is you know, maybe in her 50s, but has a lot of other issues, pre-existing issues. She doesn't get the care that she should have because perhaps she's Hispanic, but also because she doesn't have the support from her community. These are all civil rights issues. These cut across the political spectrum. And these are things that this task force are hoping to address, but also something that the entire healthcare industry, our political leaders really need to work on. And the beauty of it is it cuts across ideological lines and the political spectrum.
So for someone who's listening to this, Lewis, quickly, and then Alexandra, what can they practically do to help protect these people?
Yeah, I think I'll let Alex talk about that. We've identified some of those things at the task force. And the key thing, I think one of the key things is to educate yourself about what I should have prepared for my family members should something happen. That is absolutely huge. But then also number one, but number two, thinking about, okay, what are the things that I can do for my health, for my family's health, to increase that health, to get the access that I should, and what are some of the policies and programs that might help do that? But I'll let Alex answer that because she's the ace on that.
Yeah, I want to back up too and talk about a little bit when Lewis was talking about access to healthcare, because this is going to be a huge issue coming up in this next year. So what happened with the Affordable Care Act is that tens of millions of people were now suddenly eligible for Medicaid. And so they all got an insurance card and said, here's your access to healthcare. And what they don't realize, and what a lot of people don't realize, is that Medicare patients, those patients, when they go into the hospitals are reimbursed at a rate of about 30 to 40 cents, 40 cents at best, for the care that is given to those patients. So if those patients are in the ICU, or if they have a chronic condition, they need prolonged care, that care at some point, and often very soon, I'm talking about within 24 to 48 hours, the hospital is looking at that patient as a drain on the resources of the hospital. And that's something that is not talked about. And I think because we're going to hear a lot more about a single payer system and universal healthcare and all of these things. And we have to be very clear that a health insurance card does not equal access to healthcare. And that's why so many of the patients that we intervene on behalf of are Medicaid patients, and they're at exactly that point. They go to the hospital, they think they have care. We get a call from their loved one saying, we have insurance, what is happening here? And the hospital is saying, we need to get rid of this patient. And I know that sounds crass, and not every hospital is like that, but ultimately that's what it comes down to.
And to put a fine point on it, there were two cases in Michigan in 2019, both involving teenagers. One was a Hispanic boy who I think was around, you know, he was in his early teens. Yep. And the second, an African-American boy who was going to a Jesuit high school in Detroit, Titus Cromer, Bobby Reyes, both situations where, you know, the hospitals believed that the young men were brain deaf. They made that determination in a way that we believed lacked the certainty necessary. And they very quickly decided, hey, we want to stop treatment against the wishes of the family. And they were doing this, these weren't months long cases. These were matters of a few weeks or a few days. And so when we've seen that rush from hospitals, and particularly one of our partners, Bobby Schindler from the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network, when we've seen cases where a hospital believes that a patient's brain dead, but it's not clear that that has actually occurred. And I think there's issues with brain death more broadly, but that's a different conversation. Too often when the hospitals are seeking to stop treatment for patients that they believe are brain dead, where it's not certain that they are in fact brain dead, too often, it shouldn't happen to anyone, but Bobby has seen that often those are patients that are poor and often that they're patients that are African-American and Hispanic. And so again, these are issues that cut across the racial spectrum, cut across the political spectrum, and these are truly civil rights issues, not just religious freedom, which is absolutely important and preeminent along with the life issue. But when we talk about the life issue by way of example, these we're really talking about conception, of course, and the unborn, but we're also talking about people walking around here whose dignity and rights aren't being protected, and people need to be aware of that.
Yeah.
What can we do about all of this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it is interesting, right? Because I lived in Europe for 14 years before coming back to the US. And so, you know, their health systems are very different. And it was very interesting to see, particularly the 9 years that I lived in Italy, how, you know, everyone had access to healthcare, but when you went to the hospital, you were waiting hours and hours and hours to be seen. And then if you needed a procedure, then you were put into a long waiting list. You know, and so even though it was free, quote unquote, you know, it was basically being paid for by taxes, the actual quality of service was fairly low. The situation in France was a little bit better, but even there, it was clear that the situation is just out of control. So I think, you know, healthcare reform in a true way is very important. But what we're seeing right now, I think, is just cost cutting. So we're trying to make ends meet, and we're trying to cut costs again from a very utilitarian perspective, right? So that we're gonna try and you know make the stretch the dollars that we have, et cetera, but at the cost of patients' rights, patients' lives, and that to me is a real ethical issue. I think we need to take a step back in a sense and say, all right, so what are the fundamental values involved here? And if there's not enough money, then how do we, you know, rethink this? Because it's clear that the economics are important, but the economics are not the only thing to be considered. The rights of patients, the dignity of patients, the ability of family members to actually have a say in the treatment of their family members, you know, one of the things that we push a lot at the National Catholic Bioethics Center is the medical power of attorney or the medical proxy. So when you have your end of life planning, one of the most dangerous things is to have, you know, your living will filled out or your, you know, physician's order for life sustaining treatment, the pulse form filled out, and the hospital just saying, okay, so we have this and we're going to run with it. And in some cases, against the current wishes of the patient, against the wishes of the family, et cetera, say, look, we're going to suspend all treatment because it said here in the form, you know, that was filled out 20 years ago that I don't want this or I don't want that. The best ethical decision-making has to take into account the circumstances, what's going on right now. And the difficulty with a lot of these advanced directives is that we just don't know how we're going to feel, and we don't know what the state of medical technology is going to be. All these different things are unknown to us 20, 30 years in advance. So one thing that the task force and the National Catholic Bioethics Center really push is to try to get your affairs in order in terms of having a person you really trust who can be the healthcare proxy, the one who has the power of attorney, and who can, you know, be an advocate. Because otherwise, there is a real risk for people in the hospital. The hospital is going to be making decisions that aren't necessarily in the best interest of the patient. Maybe they're in the best financial interest of the hospital.
I actually just printed out a medical healthcare proxy form, having been in the hospital for an emergency a week or so ago, realizing, yeah, I need somebody to be advocating for me if I can't speak for myself. And this is really what Christ Medicus Foundation, why it exists, right, Lewis? To rethink healthcare in a sense, because Christians shouldn't be in the situation where they're just at the mercy of big institutions who don't know them. And you know, thank God a week or so ago, I had a doctor friend I could text to ask for advice because I was not getting the help I needed, you know? And I thought of all the people who don't have healthcare and do not have a friend they can text, you know? So how do we do healthcare better, Lewis?
Right. At the Christ Medicus Foundation, we're founded by an amazing man, Mike O'Day. And the Lord gave him a vision that really just comes from scripture of the need, the vital need, the obligation to go out and share the love of God with every human person in healthcare. That we should have a healthcare system that cares for the whole person, body, mind, and soul, that does the maximum possible to care for and accompany people in their physical health, but also cares for even more so their eternal health, which is forever. And that's what we need. We need a healthcare system that is centered on the human person and the relationship with God, and puts the system at the service of the person, regardless of what they look like, regardless of how much they can pay, regardless of their social status, their race, their color, et cetera, regardless of their productivity within the economy, right? That treats every patient the same in the reality of their elevated dignity, puts them and the relationship with God at the center of the system. But we have a patient-centered system of healthcare, as opposed to a system that is centered on the government or the industry. That's a industry. We should have a healthcare system that serves the person, as opposed to the person serving the system. That's what we need. And it calls to mind, Catherine, in this year that has been tough, but Christ reigns and we always have hope because of our God. Notwithstanding that, there's a need, there's an opportunity, as much pain as we've had, to have a new awakening of love for God and love for neighbor. We need that across the board in our country, on the personal, but also in the public. And I think we're doing that by the grace of God. We're doing that at Christ Medicus in healthcare, a new awakening of this love of God and love of neighbor. That is the golden rule. That cuts across even religious boundaries on a certain level. People understand that. And we need to do that in healthcare. We need to do that now, particularly as we close out 2020, God willing, and look into 2021. It's really needed in a way that it hasn't been needed in at least 90 years in our country.
Alexander, what practical things can policymakers be doing? What do you really want to communicate to people at this moment about making this picture better?
So I think one thing that's really important for policymakers and just for all of us is to really be aware of the shift that has taken place in our culture over the last, 30 years, but especially over the last 5 to 10 years, that this marked shift, we call it a culture of death, utilitarianism, it is a radically secular and utilitarian view of the human person, so that that people are only as good as their ability and their capacity to contribute something to society. That is a fundamentally flawed and I would say wicked view of human beings. And this is what is at the core of abortion, and this is what is at the core of this denial of life-sustaining care or denial of basic rights in healthcare. So, we have to educate ourselves, and we have to be aware that this is what's happening, and this is being taught in all of our medical schools as well. So doctors are coming out of medical school, if they're not Christian, if they're not Catholic, and they don't have a view of inherent human dignity, they are coming out viewing people through this lens, such that even the American Bar Association has reported that many physicians have a view of disabled patients that is inherently discriminatory against those patients. Those patients are denied care much quicker than other patients. They are cut off from care. They are given a shorter lifespan, even though there's no reason for them to have a short. It is really endemic right now, and we have to take a look at that. So education is huge. Joseph mentioned, and you mentioned, advanced directives. Those are really important. I would say it's very, very important to be very specific. Even if you have a healthcare proxy, you need to be specific on your documents regarding the type of care that you want. And I always encourage people who are healthy or relatively healthy, ask for all the care, because you're not going to get all the care for very long. And if you ask for only a little bit of care, it's going to be cut off from you very quickly. So there are places on those forms where you can say, I want prolonged mechanical ventilation. I want prolonged artificial nutrition and hydration. And you may feel a little bit uncomfortable with that, but I'm just telling you, if you're not specific, that care will be cut off from you. I'll just give you, by way of an example, we had a case a couple of years ago involving a 32-year-old woman who had a heart attack. And she was, after that heart attack, she was incapacitated. So she could not speak. She couldn't really move. And the decision was made in 24 hours to put her in hospice without food. And she was, they assumed she was an organ donor. So they, what they were going to do was keep her organs alive until she basically almost died of starvation. And that is typical of these kinds of cases. And they did that because the mother said, well, she wouldn't want to live in this condition. A few days after she got into the hospice, she started moving more. She started becoming more responsive. And we got a call from her fiance saying, what is happening here? They said she was not going to recover. It looks like she might be recovering. And it even got to the point where she was starting to speak and she said, I'm hungry. They would not feed her. She was on a protocol to be denied food, and her mother had made that decision on her behalf. And that was her death sentence until we were able to intervene, and we had to go to court to get a court order to get her out and back in the hospital, where she, surprise, surprise, once she got food and proper rehabilitative care, she made almost a complete recovery in a very, very short amount of time. So be very, very specific about the type of care you want, and think very carefully before you say even an offhand comment like watching Million Dollar Baby or something. I don't want to live like that, or I would never want to live in that situation, because oftentimes these are not permanent. These are not permanent conditions. These are, you're temporarily incapacitated, and then those decisions are made for you very quickly.
We only have about 10 minutes left. So Joseph, just what do you want to make sure you communicate during this hour? Again, to policymakers and to people who are living in these times.
Yeah, I think the number one priority right now has to be, look, people are dying, and they should not be forced to die alone, right? There's no medical necessity. You know, they can be safe, they can use personal protective equipment, et cetera, but having a family member there at their side when they die is an immense comfort. Having access to the sacraments, which can be done safely again with protective equipment, et cetera, that is really a human right. And to be denying that, which is happening in a lot of different institutions, not all of them, thankfully, but in a lot of different institutions, is really terrible. And you know, we have to realize there's a huge cost of denying visitation. You know, we're not keeping people safe necessarily by doing that. In the case of nursing homes, really comes to light. We've been told through our hotline just so many times of individuals who just lost the will to live because they could no longer see their family members. And they didn't die of COVID, they died of loneliness and isolation. And that's a real, real problem throughout our society. We need to be aware of that and to be thinking hard about what we can do, you know, to preserve our health, but also to preserve our spiritual and emotional rights.
I've had many conversations with some of the Little Sisters of the Poor, who of course take care of the elderly poor. And they have amazing stories about things that happen at the end, you know, in families, healing that happens. It doesn't even have to be words. It can just be being present and having a priest come in and things that are able to be said, or just, again, the presence. And I know in my life, I've seen amazing things at the end, and that you can't even put words to in some cases. To deny people that is unconscionable. One of the questions we have, I think, is a very, very crucial question right now. People are asking, so how do we get the church to fight? How united is the church in considering how closed churches and lack of access to the sacraments are negative marks on our civil and religious rights? What can Christians do when a priest or a bishop sides with the government and keep and just closes the churches, which of course does happen some places. One thing I'll footnote, I've been saying to people this week in particular, if you have a priest who has been caring for you, thank him. You know, I went to a Dominican parish the other day for confession, and it's, you know, totally safe, but also normal. You know, some places you have to like shout your confession or something. This is, you know, the way it should be, you know. Lewis, how do we help buck up the church leaders and be a part of making sure that people have Christmas, you know, and Advent.
Religious
holidays.
Right. I think it's vital. I think what you talked about is to get out in front of it. You know, I think for those of us that are priests, you know, I'm not a priest, obviously, but for those of us that are watching that are priests or that are lay leaders, et cetera, to, you know, or pastors or rabbis, what have you, I think to reach out to other lay leaders, to other church leaders, to other priests, rabbis, bishops, to say, hey, bishop, hey, rabbi, hey, father, hey, pastor, thank you for what you're doing. We need to keep on doing this. Keep the churches open, keep the synagogue open, you know, and keep on fighting because your people need you. We're seeing that whatever we're doing, it's working. People can be healthy and safe in our synagogues and houses of worship. Let's continue to do it. And so the time to do that is now.
Yeah, literally.
The time to buck up and encourage, you know, Cardinal Smith, or I'm just using different, you know,
an Irish name is probably more.
Yeah, right. Cardinal, you know, McGillicuddy, you know, whatever we want to say, but the time to encourage our rabbis and our pastors and our cardinals and to encourage them and to really exhort them to stand up now, particularly that we know that their people can be safe in their houses of worship and that we got to stand up for religious freedom and to sound the call that Justice Alito gave that was extraordinary just last week. So I think that's essential. I also want to put a plug for our healthcarecivilrights.org website, healthcarecivilrights.org, for the FAQs that we have up around access, you know, giving people education about what happens when a family member is in need of the access to the sacraments in a healthcare setting. There's a lot of other you know, discussions and helpful tips, but very practical tips at that website, healthcarecivilrights.org. And I think we just need to continue. What you say matters. What you say to your pastor, your rabbi, your bishop, your priest, it really matters. And we have to fight now. If it comes to legal action, or if it gets to a point where we absolutely have to say no, then it comes to it. Unfortunately, as a friend of mine from Texas, and I wrote about this a little bit, we're in a situation where in too many parts of the country, religion, the freedom of religion, which is protected by the First Amendment, isn't even getting equal treatment in comparison to commercial interests. And that's unacceptable. And that's not what the founders or our constitutional framework intended.
Absolutely. And I'm such a fan of ecumenical partnerships too in front, including, you know, share the protocols that are working. You know, I'm very concerned in New York about anti-Semitism here, you know. Obviously there have been some examples where there've been too many people at funerals and things like that, but the majority of people are just trying to worship God safely. And
right.
So to share those protocols and things so that we can all be safe, but we can all worship God as we need to, you know. And the other thing I want to say, because I know Catholics in particular can be very prone to criticizing their spiritual leaders for not doing enough, and just whatever you can do to be encouraging, because it's a very difficult job and these are very difficult times. And when you know the government is totally against you, you know, that really is a difficult position to be in. And so do you approach these leaders with love and encouragement, and keep in mind that, like writers, they only hear from people when they're mad at them, when the people are mad at them and want them to do something differently. So say some thank yous too in the process, even in your frustration. Final words, Alexandra, first.
So I would say with all this, we didn't address too much the issue of visitation, but visitation is not just for companionship. Visitation is for advocacy. So when hospitals are denying visitation, they are denying advocacy. And I would argue that that advocacy is a civil right. So look at the broader picture. When you're looking at these COVID shutdowns, look at all the implications of what is happening, because people are dying because of the lockdowns, and we have to be aware of that. So, and I love your idea about encouraging our leaders and shoring them up and letting them know we will support you. If you take action, we will support you. We will have your back. And that's really important.
I think I'm going to write a note to Cardinal Dolan and tell him that I will go to jail with him.
Exactly. Yeah.
Joseph, final words.
Yeah, no, I agree that it's so important to have hope and solidarity, right? To be thinking about those who are truly suffering and not to inflict unnecessary suffering.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I always come back to as an ethicist is the cure cannot be worse than the disease. So, you know, when we're trying to keep people safe, when we're trying to be, you know, caring for the vulnerable, we have to make sure that we're actually doing that, you know, and that they're not consequences that are taking place that were unintended perhaps, but are real and are causing injustice and suffering that doesn't need to happen.
And if somebody is watching who is a priest or some other kind of spiritual leader, and you've been helping people and you've been agonizing over how to safely help people this year, thank you, thank you, thank you. And we are praying for you. And likewise, I am so grateful, Joseph, Alexandra, and Lewis, for the work that you're doing. I think it's such an encouragement to people. It's obviously such a help to people. And, you know, if there's one thing that we've learned from this year, we cannot live our lives in isolation, and we are vulnerable people who need one another. And so thank you for the advocacy work and the very practical work that you all are doing. And I see some of the commenters are saying, please have more conversations like this, because this is helpful and I think encouraging to people.
Catherine, can I get 30 seconds?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Of course I'd let you get the last word, Lewis.
No, but we have a legacy, right, in this country, whether it's Archbishop Hughes in New York with the Catholic schools, whether it's Elizabeth Ann Seton with Martin Luther King, that would say now is the time to defend our religious freedom and to protect these civil rights for conception to natural death for every American. And now is the time to stand up. It's not time to look around and just hope someone else is taking care of it. It's time for us to stand up now. We have a legacy to build on. The saints, the martyrs, those that came before us are counting on us. Future souls, born and unborn, are counting upon us. Now's the time to stand up.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that worries me, and I apologize, maybe I'll take the last word.
No, please, yeah.
Is so many people are saying, oh, thanks be to God, the year's almost over. No, that is not the approach to take. The approach to take is, yeah, somebody said the other day, God doesn't provide answers, but he provides saints. And he's calling us to do heroic things right now. And so let's go. Let's get back to work. Thank you all. And thank you everyone for watching, for making the time. Check out all of these organizations, the Life Legal Defense Foundation, the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and Christ Medicus Foundation, and of course, National Review Institute. And National Review Magazine tries to cover these issues as much as possible. So keep in touch with us. And I'll just end with this: today is the 65th anniversary of the founding of National Review. Our first issue was published 65 years ago. So I'm hoping for at least 65 years more. I won't be there for that, I'm sure. Grateful. I send a prayer up for Bill Buckley and his family and all their intentions. Thank you so much.